Let's get started.
So I think what we'll do schedule-wise, the week before Purim, I won't be here, so we'll try to do two or three Shurim. I have to look at the calendar how many weeks there are. I guess it's two maybe, before I leave. Maybe so we'll transition to Purim maybe starting next week. But I wanted to do a separate Shir, which I thought was really an interesting topic, which I think presents interesting challenges, specifically to those of us living in Israel. I think this Shir is relevant. The initial and the primary topic certainly relates more to us when we live in Chutz La'aretz. But I think that, number one, specifically when it comes to fashion, so it's a global village, so I don't think we're exclusively focused on fashion in one place or another, even when we live here. But more than that, I think that there are parallels to living in a dominant secular culture, which we certainly still do in Israel. And therefore, I'd like to discuss this very fascinating halacha question, but also, I think, a parallel in hashkafa, which I think will be very relevant to living here and not just exclusively limited to when we were living in a non-Jewish culture. But the original sources and the primary halacha discussion is in a non-Jewish culture, but I think we can find messages that are relevant to all of us as well here. So let's begin at the beginning. It's a meaty topic, but I think it's one that we can all gain a lot from. So the source of this whole from a halachic question is a pasuk in Sefer Vayikra in Perek Yud Chet, in source number one, where Hashem is telling us all about the fact that not only is He taking us out of Egypt, but He'll be taking us to the land of Canaan, which of course is the land of Israel. But before we inhabited it, there were all sorts of non-Jewish nations that lived there. And in the first half of the pasuk, it talks about how when we're leaving Egypt, this shouldn't just be a geographical exodus, but that Egypt was a land that was steeped in immorality, and therefore we have to leave that behavior behind. Kamasa Eretz Mitzrayim. But at the end of the pasuk, where you see it underlined, it says, I'm now bringing you to another country, and there'll be years and years in which there'll still be the initial, how would they say it nowadays, indigenous population of the Canaanites, and says the pasuk, Ubuchukotehem lo telechu. Even though you're going to be exposed to all their immoral ways, you can't follow them as well. But the language here chosen is one that is much more opaque and a little bit unclear. Kemaasei Eretz Mitzrayim, at least we know what the words mean. Now, what were the actions of the people of Egypt that were so bad that Chazal fill in the blank? But at least we know how to translate the words. But how do you translate the words? Ubuchukotehem lo telechu. A chok is usually a term that we're familiar with from a mitzvah that makes no sense, a mitzvah that doesn't have a reason, a statute. Okay, but how does that? What is being actually described here? What is being prohibited? So this becomes the basis of a seeming contradiction in two Gemaras, and the backdrop, just from a purely conceptual perspective, is very straightforward and makes a lot of sense. Which is, on the one hand, it would seem that there's something that's going to be usur. The Torah says there are certain things you cannot do, so something has to be usur. On the other hand, it would seem intuitively obvious that not everything can be usur. You know what I'm saying? If they wear pants, I can't wear pants. They drive a car, I can't drive a car. Like, there must be some line somewhere. And it's not at all clear from the psukim where that is. And in two very non-relevant contexts, but this is part of the beauty of Torah, we've all seen this many, many times, where you have sources which seemingly are irrelevant to us currently, but the principles can be extracted. So in two such contexts, in sources 2 and 3, the Gemara twice tries to get at the bottom of this question, where do you draw the line? And what is complicated, but I say fascinating for us, is the Gemara gives two different answers, which seem to perhaps be mutually exclusive. So let's see what the Gemara says. So the first context is source number 2, just to take you way, way back in the way back machine, when there used to be kings. And one of the halachos, which I think was true in parallel ways to non-Jewish cultures as well, and Jewish cultures, that's the whole point, but it was true even for the Jewish king, was that at the end of the king's life, he used to take his material possessions and burn them. Big, big log bomb or bonfire. And why is that? Paradoxically, that actually is considered the greatest kavod for the king. Because it shouldn't be that after the king dies, then you're going to see Yankel walking around in his I remember that. That looks like the cape that the king used to wear. It's a way of exclusivity. Side point, some of you may know this halacha. I assume there were certain perks with being the queen. A downside is that once the king dies, you can't get remarried. You get one shot at it. You better hope he lives long. Okay? So that's a parallel idea. It's just not appropriate. You can't have the king's wife now married to somebody else. That would be even retroactively disrespectful. So that's the context. Now, that's very far from the world we live in. But the point is that the Gemara itself asks, how could we have this halacha? After all, isn't there a source sheet somewhere? I don't know where they went, but there should be. The Gemara asks, how could we say this halacha? Apparently, this was also the practice in the non-Jewish cultures. The non-Jewish countries and clans were also burning and making exclusive their king's clothing. So didn't we just say you can't do what the non-Jews do? And that's the tagline of our shir. The pasuk said, "Ubechukotam lo telechu," in source number one. So the Gemara asks, how could you burn the king's clothing if the non-Jews are doing that? Aren't you imitating the goyim? So the Gemara answers, in source number two, where it's underlined, no. Kuliyama sreifa lav chukahi. This idea that you're burning the king's clothing, that's not a chok that would be prohibited by the Torah. Chukotayim lo telecho. It's not a chok. Why? Ela chashivutahi. As I already mentioned, because we're doing it for the significance, the kavod, the chashivus of the king. Now, if you were to extract, now again, this is all nice and good. This is, you know, in the Wayback Machine time, you know, when we had kings, you say, what's it got to do with us? And anyway, I'm not the king. But what's the principle that we can extract from this Gemara? What is the line for what would be usr, what would be mutter? What do you see from this Gemara? What do you think? Excellent. Right. Here, in the context of the king, the specific reason is covet. But it doesn't have to be limited to that. And that's the Gemara didn't use the term. The Gemara says there's a good reason. Why are we burning the king's clothing? It's for the chashivas of the king. There's a good reason. And of course, so that plays into the word that the Chumash used. The Chumash said, "Ubechukoteim lo telechu." So the Gemara here seems to be sensitive to the language. Chok, even in our more native context, we assume means things without a reason. Oh, things which the Goyim do. What, we think Jews are the only people who do things for no reason? We have our Mishagasin, they have their Mishagasin. So if there's something that the non-Jews are doing, which doesn't seem to have any obvious reason, so the Torah says, don't do it. Now, what's so bad about doing something the non-Jews do, we don't even know yet. We'll get to that. But what is usr? Where's the line? How do I know? They drive a car, I can't drive a car. They have a computer, I can't have a computer. So the first answer in the Gemara, the first rule is, if there's something that seems to have no good reason, a la a chok, then you cannot do something that has no good reason that the goyim are doing. They're meshigasin, we can't adopt. But something that's chashivusa, there's a good reason for it. We're not penalized because they do it. They're not penalized because we do it. We're all allowed to come up with good ideas so we can collaborate on the good ideas of the world. That's the first approach of the Gemara. It's very, very important. So now, again, you'll tell me, okay, but what this person thinks is a good idea, I think is a mishikasin. Right? Every teenager and their parents have had that exact debate many times. Right? The parents can't understand, and the kids are like, what are you talking about? This is like the best whatever. And the parents are like, this is mishuga. Okay, so which examples will fit into which category we'll fight about another day? But the principle seems to be very clear and very reasonable. Okay? The problem is that in source number three, the Gemara seems to contradict this. Now, the initial context here is also far from our current experience. The Gemara here is describing the death penalty. We know that according to the Torah, there were four types of capital punishment in the Torah. And the Gemara here is describing the one of Saif, which is use a sword. And the Gemara is discussing the gruesome details of how do you kill a person with a sword according to the Torah. And the Gemara basically describes two concepts, two ideas. One seems to be more reminiscent of the guillotine, which is that, you know, someone's kind of bent over and then someone from behind chops. And the other, for the Americans in the room, would be more like baseball. You know, the guy's standing there and you go, whap! Now, the details are not important for us per se. What is important for us is that in one case, again, you're going to tell me which one is more dehumanizing, which one seems to be more cruel, which one seems to be more painful, more ugh. But the Gemara itself has this discussion. And the Gemara says, at least in one opinion, I wouldn't do what you're doing, but because you are doing a misa menuvelet. What you're doing is just too dehumanizing. It's too embarrassing for the victim, for the criminal who's going to get punished. We don't want to do that. To which the other rabbi responds, you're probably right. I'm not happy with this in that sense, but I can't go with you what you're doing, because what you're doing, the goyim also do. The goyim kill people, and the way they kill people is the way you're saying. So what will be the answer? So that's the context. But they're trying to figure out what's the right way to kill people with a sword. Can we do it the way the goyim do it? Or can we do it, do we have to do it our own way, even if our own way seems to be more demeaning? Leave that. Now we don't care about that. Once the Gemara was discussing that, the Gemara tries to bring a proof from our case of the king in his clothing. Now we, as we're chewing through this Gemara, we're excited because now this is something familiar. We're expecting the Gemara is going to say, oh yeah, the king with the clothing. We just, I can't remember everything, but Rabbi Gottlieb just told me about that 5 minutes ago. I still remember. What did the Gemara say about the clothing? Why was it allowed? Chashivutehi, because anything that's a good reason, we can't do the mishigasim of the goyim, but we can do a regular thing. But take a look at source number 3 where it's underlined. That's not what the Gemara says here. The Gemara in the middle of source number 3, when asked the question about burning the king's clothing, and we expect that the Gemara is going to answer, oh yeah, the reason it's allowed to burn the king's clothing is because it's for his kavod. It's not stam mishigas, but that's not what the Gemara answers. The Gemara answers, look at, actually, you know, well, I could have read it from two different places. Let's read towards the bottom of source number 3. Kavan dichsiv sreifa ba'oraisa. Since there is a Tanakh source for burning the king's clothing, and the Gemara here quotes a pasuk in the Navi Yirmiyah, lav minayhu kagamrinan. We didn't learn it from them. And then the Gemara goes to apply that to the execution issue of the sword. Again, but I don't want to get too much in the details of the sword already. I see a look on your faces. Okay? I don't want anyone to use the sword on me. Okay. So, what did we just do? What did I think there's another sheet. There might be one more sheet in this assignment. What did we see from this? The Gemara is bothered by a similar question. Whether it's the sword, whether it's the king's clothing. But the Gemara yet again is bothered by the question of, where's the line? How can we do things the goyim are also doing? But instead of the Gemara here giving the answer, what was the original answer? Is it something that makes sense? We have a good reason for? Or it's the mishigasim of the goyim? And that was, we know where to draw the line. What answer did the Gemara here give? Didn't say anything about mishigasim, good reasons. What does the Gemara say here? It all depends on what's the source. Who got it first? Are we learning it from them? Minayhu kagamrina, we learned it from them? Then it's usher. But if it's something that we didn't learn from them, I opened up the Tanakh. And in Yirmiyah it says they burn the king's clothing, so I can burn the king's clothing. Or the Torah says, Sayef, the Torah says a sword. I didn't get the idea of killing the people with a sword from the goyim. I got it because it says in our Chumash. Now you understand, although I can't tell if you understand. I'm looking for some recognition here in your eyes. So I'm trying. This seems to be a contradiction. We have the same question in two different sources, but completely different answers. The first answer is, how do you know where to draw the line? Again, the assumption intuitively, unspoken, is it can't be everything the goyim do is usher for us. We won't be able to function. It's just absurd. It can't be what the Torah had in mind. So there has to be some line. The first, Gemara said, where's the line? If there's a good reason or not. They had a good reason to do something. We can adopt it. We can learn from them. Why not? It's a mishigas. Okay, that we shouldn't do. The second Gemara says, no, it's all about who got there first, the origin. We have to be pure, so to speak. It has to be all Torah only, Jewish only. If we got it, if it's an ancient, original Jewish source, fine. But if we can map that originally we learned it from the Goyim, that's already a problem. Now, those aren't just two different interpretations. This is going to be a massive halachic difference. Which of those two interpretations is much more strict and much more machmir? The second one is much more machmir. This is a big deal, ladies. If we accept the second Gemara, anything that was not an originally Jewish idea, usher.
The Jews came up with a lot of good ideas.
Okay, so the good news is, we got Facebook, we got this, we got that, I don't even know what else, Ralph Lauren, we could go through Calvin Klein, we could go through all the things. But at some point, we're going to fall short. Now, this is a major contradiction, which has major impact. So there's all sorts of different interpretations on how to resolve this, but when you get to the Shulchan Aruch and practical, which is what we want to focus on, there seem to be two main approaches, which may or not be combinable. Source number four, one interpretation, one suggestion of how to resolve this, is from the Ran. And the Ran says, "Lefi shelo asra Torah el chukos she'odavod kachavim." What does that mean when the Torah said you can't do the chukim of the goyim? Devarim shel hevel ubatola v'kulan yesh behen tzorach avodas kachavim. Says the Ran, we go with the first Gemara. The first Gemara said, what's Asr? Mishigasin, things that have no reason. But now the Ran offers us something that now we can sink our teeth into. What's so bad about a Mishigas? Everything I do has to have such a good reason. I do things. What could be bad about that? So says the Ran something very fascinating, which I think is a little bit foreign to us, because we live, all of us, the younger and the older in this room, we've all more or less been born into a very secular world. Europe, Garshver, even America is getting more and more secular. None of us grew up in like the Middle Ages or earlier, where the whole world was religious. The question is, which religion? So we're not as sensitive to this as the Rishonim were, I don't think. But they, you know, we're nervous like that Avodah Zarah was lurking around every corner. So says the Ran, obviously I'm not going to tell you it's usur. We don't need this pasuk to tell me you can't, I don't know, wear a cross. That we have like things in the Ten Commandments for. We don't need an obscure pasuk in Vayikra for that. What this pasuk, this halacha is teaching us, is that things that seem to have no reason that the Goyim are doing, you're getting it from them. Getting it from them per se is not the problem. But if you can't think of any good reason to do it, any obvious reason, we have to suspect what? That whether you realize it or not, and I'll add whether even they realize it or not, but maybe the origin of this thing goes back to Avodah Zarah. And therefore this pasuk, this halacha is teaching us we're so paranoid about Avodah Zarah, we don't just say to you, you know, don't wear a rosary, don't put on a cross, I don't know, whatever would be an example in Islam, or get the Buddha, baby Buddha. That's obvious. It's even things that are clearly goyish, that have no obvious reason, stay away from those, because you never know, maybe it goes back to Avodah Zarah. We don't think, we're not hardwired even thinking that. That would not be the first thing that came to my mind about something that made no sense. Oh yeah, probably the goyim 500 years ago, 800 years ago. And again, I'm pointing out, it's not just that you and I wouldn't have thought of it. It could be that Joe or Jane now doesn't realize that it has Avodah Zarah origins. It's just something that people have been doing for hundreds of years. Could be. So, I don't know if this is actually true, but the first time I taught this Ran to somebody, they told me, and I've been very makbid on it ever since, I hope, I don't know if it's correct or not, they told me that one of the reasons that people go cheers and clink the glasses was a pagan thing to scare away the spirits. Now, somebody subsequently told me that they think that there's an additional reason, which is that people were worried that you were poisoning them. So when they would clink the glasses, your beer would go into his beer, her beer would go into her beer, and then everyone would have a little bit of a mixture, and then you'd have to worry that no one's trying to poison you. I didn't spend any time really researching this. But I can tell you, not that I have too many l'chaims, but a lot of times people say l'chaim even now, and I've been, like, for 20 years, I haven't clinked a glass. Because someone told me that might be an example of this phenomenon. That there's no, what's the, because it, despite the fact that we've all seen this in like every book or every movie we've ever seen for the last 20 or 30 or 50 years of our lives, if you think about it for a second, does it make any sense to clink a glass? There's no logic. That's a mishigas. That's an Irish guy. There's no reason to clink glasses. Even the word cheers, I guess, in l'chaim, okay, it's a nice, it's a cheap bracha that we're giving our friend. But what's the clinking of the glass? It's shtuyot. No one knows why they're doing it. Nobody. So maybe it's because I had an Avodah Zarah. So the Ran would say, yeah, there's no good reason, then don't do it. I, your coworkers, the people you're at the bar with, the people you're having the business meeting with, they don't know why they're doing it either. Doesn't matter. 800 years ago in Scotland or whatever, maybe this was why. Okay, that would be the Ran's approach. We are constantly nervous and neurotic. Not about chametz, that's coming. When that's only 8 days a year, but we're neurotic about Avodah Zarah all the time. That's the Ran's approach. Okay? Very interesting. Take a look, however, at source number five. The Marik, Rav Yosef Cologne, who eventually became a very prominent rabbi in Italy, The Rambam was from Spain. That we're more familiar with great rabbis from Spain. But here we have one of the Italian rabbis. And he discusses something very interesting. I never did an intellectual history survey to see what was happening not only in other countries when he was writing. But he says in his day in Italy, the following invention was instituted by the government and by the society around them. Take a look at source number 5. Al-Davar Hey Kuf Pe Aleph. Anyone know what that is? Pronounce it. It's not an abbreviation. Pronounce it. What's the word?
Akpa.
Getting closer. So what do you think that is? Give me an English word.
Cafe.
Close? Okay, not really close. Because you at least have the right letters.
Kapow.
Yeah, maybe. English. Give me an English word. This is referred to as a cape. A kappa. What's he referring to? Keep on reading. And he describes it. You want to know what the fashion was like? Aruka ad la'aretz was very long. Holechet panim va'achor, open front and back. Covering in front and back, but petucha open on the sides. Got a nice vent. What was it done for? And it's done in a way it's rounded on the bottom, so there's no tzitzis issue. That's not the issue. But what was the problem? This was instituted in the time of the Marik by the government. All doctors had to wear capes. This is the origin of the doctor's coat. Again, I don't know what was happening in Germany and Spain. Maybe it was before. I don't know. But in Italy, we know when this was instituted. This idea that the doctor has to wear the white coat. So it wasn't a white coat then. It was a black cape. But the idea that everyone should know who the doctor is, they have to wear the coat. In this case, the kappa, the cape.
When was this?
I'm blanking for a moment. I think maybe. I have to double check it. I can double check it.
Is that where the word kapata comes from?
I have no idea. That's very possible. One second. Let me just let's see if we can find this ant quickly. This is an interesting point. It's not going to affect this year. Actually, I don't have any service in here. I don't know. Anyway, I don't have service here. Anyway, so a few hundred years ago. It's not 100 years ago. Maybe in the 1500s. I can't remember. Is it the 1500s or 1600s? He's not later than that, for sure not. Okay. Anyway, so what was important, like now, was true in Italy in those days. Lots of Jewish doctors. So the Yiddish doctors were asking the Marik, are we allowed to wear this cape? Maybe this is a problem of Chukos Hakom. So out of that,
1630,
okay, thank you. So yeah, I was off. I said 1500 or 1600, so I was half right. Thank you. Okay, so over 400 years ago. Okay, so he says that's in Italy when they started with the cape. So that leads him down this road of trying to analyze. Where's the line? So he suggests two things. He says, number one, which is the second thing he's going to mention, I don't want to emphasize it, he says, anything that's not sanua, pritza stick. Now you think, what does pritza have to do with this? And the answer, which is actually not our topic, but very profound. What he makes the point, he writes this explicitly towards the bottom, says, modesty is an innately Jewish trait. So to be immodest is not only a problematic because of the sensuality factor, but by definition, it's already non-Jewish. Once you're doing things which are obviously pritzistic, you're also, by definition, also doing things that are goyish. Because a Jew is tsanua. You don't need to think in those terms. No. Because we're so far removed from it, unfortunately. But it's a very profound hashkafic point about tznius. Anyway, but that's one thing. He says, number one, anything that's overtly and obviously not sanua. So not only is the rabbi going to yell at you for not being tznius, but it's also a problem with chukos hakom, because Jews are tsanua. That's number one. It's the second reason he mentions it, but that's the first point for us. But let's leave that now to the side. Go back to the part where he has it, where I have it underlined in middle number 5. He says, but what's the other reason? And his main reason? And he goes back again to the word chok. So he also says, this is about mishigasin, things that don't make any sense. But unlike the Ran, writing in an earlier century in a different country in Christian Spain, unlike the Ran, who was worried about avodah zarah around every corner, who said if you don't know why you're doing it, maybe you don't realize it, but maybe it's pagan in origin. Look what the Marik says, middle of the source number 5. Kevushu osa davar mishuna. You're doing some weird mishigas that has no obvious reason. It's just a haim noag in Cain. People are doing it. The He didn't say anywhere about religion. What I think he's getting at is something different. Imitation is the highest form of flattery. If you are a Jew in a non-Jewish dominant society, it's not at all shocking that you might have insecurity. You might be trying to fit in. You want to look American. You want to look European. You want to look British. You want to fit in. And therefore, you don't just say, oh, my neighbor, the non-Jew, has a good idea. I'm going to do that too. That's no problem with that. We're not the only ones. We don't have a monopoly on good ideas. We can take good ideas from the non-Jews. But this idea that I don't want them to look at me different, I want to fit in, I want to be a good American, I want to be a good European, good German. So therefore I'm going to do even the Narishkeit that he does, just so he'll feel like I'm part of them. That's the Yisr. That insecurity, that lack of Jewish pride, that willingness to say, I'm an Ivri, like Avram, I'm different. And it's not just that I pray differently than you, I even look a little differently than you. That desire, the insecurity, I want to be like you, that is the prohibition. I think he's not even discussing paganism and maybe there 800 years ago you'll find that it was a Christian thing, a pagan thing. This is not the point. The point is a Jew should be proud of who he is or she is and not doing things just to be like them. Okay? If you take a look a little bit just to wrap this up, it's such an important source. Number five, look at the last line. He circles back and he makes the point. Second to last line. Anything that is mitkaven lihidamot elehem. You're doing it because you want to be like them. Not that you happen to do it or there's a good reason to do it. I want to be like them. Why are you wearing that dress? Why you put on that suit? Why are you wearing a tie? Oh, because the guy who do it, I want to be like them. I want to fit in. I want to look like every other American. I want to look like every other. That is the problem, he says. But if you were doing it for some other reason, then there's no problem at all. And he makes the point, this is very profound, the last line, Ein ha-Yisrael mechuyav l'hishtanot min ha-goy klal. There's no halacha. This is underlined, highlighted. Says the Marik, there's no such thing as a halacha that per se we have to look differently than the Goyim. There might be hashkafa, there might be advice, we'll get to that. But halachically, there's no reason we can't dress like them per se. The caveat is, if the reason that we're doing the same thing as them is because it makes sense. If there's a good reason to be like them, and you say, oh, how could you do it? It's like the Goyim. Says the Marik, there's no problem about doing the same thing as them. We don't have to behave differently if it's not against the Torah. We don't have to dress differently if it's not against the Torah. Per se. But if it's more subjective, it's more psychological, emotional. Why are you doing this? Because you went to the store and that's happened to be what they're selling and you think this is pretty, so that's why you did it? Okay. You came home and the non-Jewish neighbor down the block had the same dress as you? I can't do it. You might not want to have the same dress as your neighbor. I've been told that's like a thing. I can tell you it's not a thing among men. But the fact that they have the same dress, you have good taste and I have good taste. We both thought it was pretty. Nothing wrong with that, says the Marik. There's no wrong problem per se. The problem is in the attitude. If the reason you're doing it is because you want to be, and says the Marik, what's the litmus test? If it's an Irishkeit, if there's no good reason. So then why else are you doing it? Now, if we would ask the Ron in Spain, he would say, you know why else you're doing it? You don't even realize it, but you're connecting to Avodah Zarah. Here isn't anything about Avodah Zarah. Just Jewish pride. Who are you? Are you trying to be like a guy or are you trying to be like a Jew? That's his approach. Now, you see this come up in some other sources. So, for example, we won't read it all now, but even in source number 6, this has a practical ramification. The Bach talks about haircuts. Right? You know, now some of us who have teenage boys are worrying that they're going to get a fade, they're going to get there's certain kind of haircuts that we don't, you know, when I say we, I guess I mean me, and other parents, I think, not only me, don't always like that our kids would get. Well, that's not a new thing in the 21st century. This is always the case. And actually used to be more institutionalized, like certain things, the Jews had this, or the non-Jews had this kind of haircut. So the Bach talks about, he's in Poland at the time of the Shulchan Aruch, source number 6, he's talking about if you have people who are Karev Lamalchus, Shtadlonim, as we used to call them. You know, people who are, they work at the highest echelons of the OU or the Aguda, you know, or AIPAC, and they're, you know, lobbying and they get involved with the king and the prime minister. But in order to be able to have that access, they had to have a certain haircut. Okay, we can't, it's not our world, but there used to be such a thing. So says the Bach, it's mutter. Even though there's a halach about haircuts in the Shulchan Aruch. Again, if we don't live in such a world, but if there would be such a world where, you know, all goyim have this haircut, so how could a Jew do it? So, because you're not doing it to be like them. You're doing it because you have a good reason. You need access to the king, and this is the way you'll get it. Or, for example, if you take a look in, we'll circle back, I promise. If you take a look at source number 9, just for a moment, I'm a huge fan of this source. Source number 9, we're going to get back to the first side of the page in a minute. But if you take a look at source number 9, we're skipping way ahead to more recent years. Chuvas B'nai Banim, we've quoted this source every now and then in the past. This was Rav Yehuda Herzl Henkin, Zecharo Livracha, who passed away not that long ago. He was the husband of Rabbanit Henkin, the founder and the head of Nishmat. He was also the grandson of Rav Yosef Eliyahu Henkin, who was like the Gadol Hador in America before Moshe Feinstein. And he himself was a very fine and accomplished Talmid Chacham who wrote many Sfarim. So in his tshuva on this topic, source number 9, he writes that someone sent him a letter or some other manuscript from the Chazon Ish. Pretty impeccable from credentials, the Chazon Ish. And the Chazon Ish wrote as follows. Look at where it's underlined, source number 9. Isser b'chuko teim lo teilechu, einu ela, what's the nature of this prohibition? And I love this formulation. B'mis'ave lehidemot lehem.
The desire.
Because it's all about that subjectivity. It's all about that emotional. The kishk is what's inside of you. Why are you doing this? Because I have a desire, a taiva, a desire. I want to be like them. I want to be accepted by them. I want to be like the goyim. That's the problem. But if it's a question of, I went into the store, my fashion sense says that this is attractive. This is good looking, this is pretty, I want to dress this way, I want to wear this men's suit, I want to wear this woman's dress. It's not that I want to be like the movie star who I saw on TV at the Emmys was wearing that. Right? There's an entire culture built around, entire industries actually, not only the fashion industry, right, the marketing industry, right? It's all about creating this desire to imitate, to want to be like them. Says the Chazon Ish, that's the Isser. That is the Isser. Assuming it's Tzanua and B'Kavadik, it's not per se, you know, sometimes men have 3-button suits, sometimes they have double-breasted suits, sometimes they have 2-button suits. There was a time when I was a kid where all men who knew anything about fashion had cuffed pants in their suits. Now you would never have a cuffed suit. These things can change, it's usually all sorts of not. In the end of the day, you have to ask yourself, when you go into the store, when you come out with that clothing, when you look at yourself in the mirror, am I wearing this, am I purchasing these things because I like the way they look? No person, I mean, I'm saying almost nobody is such a blank slate that they are going to be beyond, you know, in a hermetically sealed box in which they have no impact on what's happening around them. Of course, our own, you know, if you or I, with the exact same DNA, was born in the Middle East, you know, 200 years ago, I assume our fashion sense would be different. There's no way, you can't avoid that. But that's not the problem, says the Chazon Ish. And again, he doesn't quote him, but who does this Chazon Ish sound like? Exactly, like the Ma'arik. It's about the, I want to be like, the imitation is the flattery, that's the problem. So you say, of course we're going to be somehow affected. I imagine we all would have different fashion senses if we lived in a different century or in a different country. But wherever we are, with whatever fashion sense has somehow, you know, globbed onto our brain, now why am I doing this? Because that's in, and when I say in, I don't mean because all the ladies in shul are dressed that way. Where Moshe Feinstein is going to address that point. I'm not saying I'm impressed by such a mentality, but it wouldn't be usher if you just want to be like the other fancy Jewish ladies, the other women in the shul down the block. But no, because this is what the goyim are doing, this is what the movie stars are doing, this is what the elite of the society are doing, this is what the politicians are doing, whoever it is that you look up to in that, if you were living in a dominant secular or non-Jewish society. I need to tell you, there are many Jews, consciously, sometimes, and certainly subconsciously, but even consciously, who this is exactly their motivation. They want to be accepted. They want to look like everybody else. They don't want anyone to give a second look when they walk down the street.
So
that's the
motivation. The motivation.
Yes, in many ways. Again, there could be an objective thing, like if it's preetzus, he said, that could be. But yes, exactly the point. Two people, I want to make that point exactly as Mrs. Simon said. Two people could go into the same store, walk out with the same dress, or the same suit, or the same pair of shoes, and for one it could be usher, for one it could be mutter. Exactly. Because I picked the shoes because I thought they're pretty, because they're sharp. They're comfortable. Oh, who thought about that? Comfortable? Shoes are allowed to be comfortable? It's a chiddush for most women. But other persons say, oh, I do this because I was watching on TV last night and my favorite movie star or the favorite music person had these shoes and I heard these are the in shoes and an Instagram influencer said these are the right shoes or whatever, narshkeit. Yeah, that's a problem. Now, again, when the narshkeit is internal, we have other problems. Like the frum influencers and the frum celebrities and the frum styles, that's a separate narshkeit, but at least it's not this isser. Yeah.
Two things. First of all, I feel like this is not how halacha works. Like, usually things are like lopuk, like not dependent on your intention. Like, it just seems like something that.
Yeah, it's a little bit more. I think it is more fluid. I think it's contextual. I'll say it that way. I'm comfortable. Again, the Chazanish used this line of mit'ave, which I like a lot, which sounds subjective. That's a fair point. But I think it's the broader point is it's contextual. In different contexts, ein hachanami, some things can be prohibited. This can change. It can change from generation to generation, the details, and it can even theoretically change from person to person. The nature, the isser is, it's not that there's some isser or some mitzvah, which we're changing from person to person, as much as the isser is the mentality. So it's not changing. It's just it's one gut. It's not that the getter is changing. It's one getter. It's just that you might violate it getting this pair of clothing, and I might violate it getting a different pair of clothing.
Right, but then I feel like there's such a fine line. Sometimes
yes.
You want to get something because you think it looks nice, but it also happens to be that you saw it first on.
Again, but that's the point. Again, seeing it first is not the problem.
Right. I don't know. I feel like it's very hard for people to.
Okay. Again, I think, for better and for worse, I think at this point, at least in our community, most people are a little bit far away from this. Because I think, thank God, the outside community has shown to be how bankrupt they are.
Who would want
to? Teenagers is the big thing. So we're going to, again, technically, halachically, I might have a heter anyway. But of course, it's an issue for teenagers. I will tell you, again, this is going to be more foreign to the women in this room, but if you were, certainly if you were a male in my generation, maybe there are girls who like sports too. I don't want to be totally prejudiced. But certainly in my generation, which was even less common for girls to like sports. When I was a kid, the most successful and the biggest marketing campaign by far, multi-billion dollar marketing campaign, was exactly based on what this would be saying is usher. And that was the Nike campaign. Chicagoan. All around the Michael Jordan sneakers. And it wasn't that they're cool and they look good. Or they're comfortable. That was also true. But they understood that people wanted to be like Mike.
Isn't it the same as wearing a jersey? Why would anyone wear a jersey?
Maybe. Or just, it's a way of showing my fandom for the team. That's not the same thing, I don't think. But this idea was when I was in fifth grade, and my parents, I don't know what, I must have been either so well-behaved or so badly behaved. You know, as we know, the parents usually are spending more time on the two extremes. I don't remember which one it was. But I could not believe, not version one, but version two, I think it was, of the Air Jordans, which was like, it was crazy. It was like $100. Now it's like you can't even find some. No, I'm saying this is in 1980, whatever. It was $100. That was $100 was real money. My parents got me the black and blue Jordans. Oh, I was like floating down the street. I was so cool, so happy. And more importantly, I was like Mike. And again, it's not the end of the world. I was fifth grade, sixth grade. But that is the issue. If you transfer that to an adult, and again, it doesn't have to be a particular celebrity. That's a different. That's a very narrow example. But when you turn the whole broader culture, the secular culture, the Gush culture, into Mike, and you want to be like Mike, that is the problem. Let's see how we paskin. Take a look at the Shulchan, the Ramah, source number 7. So the Ramah does something very interesting. The Ramah, and I went over for years. I was bothered by this Ramah. Until I found that Moshe Feinstein agreed with me. He read it like me. So I feel like I'm in good company. The Ramah combines the two. Okay, we saw source number 4 and 5, the Ran and the Ramarik. And just to be clear, in the Gottlieb interpretation, they are very, very different. Because the Ran in source number 4 was panicked, was neurotic, you could say, about paganism, Avodah Zarah. Could be anywhere. You never know. So don't do anything that doesn't make any sense because you never know. Maybe 900 years ago in, you know, southern France, they did it for an Avodah Zarah. Whereas I was interpreting the Ma'arik, like the Chazon Ish and others, It's all about imitation is the highest form of flattery. They're not the same thing. You could easily imagine a case where one would agree and one would say Asr, one would say Mutter. Okay, but take a look at the Rama, source number 7. So on the one hand, he starts off by saying we're supposed to be different. Mubdol mehem, we should be different in our behavior and our clothing. But then he says, okay, it can't be wrong. We don't have to do everything differently. So the first reason is, if the goyim are doing this for pritzus, that is a problem. So I'm not sure what would fit into that now. But if there was something that wasn't, if you could imagine something that's not usser, right? We're not discussing now knees and elbows or something like that. Something that might technically be mutter. But it's done in order to be alluring. It's done in order to be more sensual. So maybe that would be, I don't have anything in mind. But if there is something that we could imagine, okay, because often there's just more obvious, blatant, tznius problems without getting into chukas akum. But if there was something that didn't technically cross the line, but it was just, no, there's a reason people do this. That is also a chukas akum problem. Okay, that's not our focus today, but that we see this already in the Shulchan Aruch. But now comes the part that's more intriguing to us. Here we get it. No reason. A chok. Narishkeit. Silliness. Mishigasin. What's the problem with that? So who is the Rama paskening like? Source number 4, the Ran. He's worried about Avodah Zarah. He's bringing down the Ran. Now for our purposes, that might be a good thing, because again, we've lived in a world which is so thoroughly secular for so long. It could be that there really are very hard to find things which are... I'm not even sure my example of clicking the glasses was accurate. And what else would you even think of? So, but that's what he gives. But if there's a good reason to do it. And now what's his example of a good reason to do it? His good reason to do it is the doctor's cape. Now what did he do? By giving the example of the doctor's cape, he's conflating 4 and 5. Now if you see source number five, the doctor's cape, it's just an example. Haircuts are an example. A doctor's coat is an example. I can imagine you have a frum person. Maybe he's lucky enough to go start Einstein next year.
Yeah.
Okay. And all of a sudden he's so excited, and then he says to his rabbi, one second, I thought I had this great opportunity to be a doctor, but now they tell me I have to wear this white coat, and all the goyim are wearing it, so maybe it's not allowed. So the rabbi was like, no, it's okay, it's allowed. This is discussed already 400 years ago in Italy. And the rabbi's already there, discussed, and Shulchan Aruch paskin, for a doctor to wear a coat, because that's what he needs for professional reasons.
It's a uniform.
Yes, exactly. He's doing it for professional reasons. He wants to make a parnasa. He wants to do good in the world. And the only way to do that is to wear the cape. He also has to go to school. Who's going to say, he also has to go to medical school. He also has to wear the cape. If he's only giving it as an example, fine. But what did we point out? And this bothered me for years. That you can't just randomly pick an example of the doctor's coat, in my opinion, when source number 5, the Ma'arik, conceptually has a completely different outlook. I don't think he agrees with the Ran. The Ran is paranoid about Avodah Zarah and paganism. And the Rama brings that. He quotes that. We know that. But I don't think that's what the Ma'arik was worried about at all. The Ma'arik was worried about imitation. Or as the Chazon Ish put it, mit'aveh lihidamot b'hem. You're desirous. You want to be like them. So I was bothered for many years by this combination. And if you take a look now in source number 11, which is a very, very important source for all of us in our generation, he's talking about America, but I assume this would have been equally true in England or other such countries after the war. What happened, Rav Moshe Feinstein, I'm not sure if it's written, but if it is written, I forget what the exact date of this tshuva was. But as you can see from the context, he's writing shortly after World War II. Because what happened? You had this huge influx of European immigrants. Again, a much smaller number than that had been alive 10 years earlier. But all of a sudden, American Jewry got transformed. So you had some relatively modern or even secular German Jews who survived, but you had huge numbers, relatively speaking, of Polisha. That's he specifically talked about, Polin. Now, in this context, what is Polisha a code word for?
Hasidish.
My puppy is 80. And the question, again, I don't know who asked him. The question was, from the Hasidim, do we have to continue dressing like we did in Poland? And he gives examples. He doesn't talk about the shrine, he talks about long coats, i.e. the bekasha. Or can we wear the short coats? You know, because there used to be a day where no man would walk around the street without a suit jacket. So can they wear suit jackets? That was the question. It sounds, you know, almost, you know, from our very distance of number of decades and not being Hasidish, but this was a very profound question for them. So in that context, so first of all, Rav Moshe rules that from a halachic perspective, there's no problem wearing the short coat. You don't have to dress like a chassid. There's no need. And he quotes the Maharik. What did the Maharik say in the last line? We read it before. There's no chiyah for a Jew to look differently than a goy. Per se. Ein ha-Yisrael mechayav lihishtanot men a-goy klal. You have a Rishon writing this. It's very, very, very unequivocal language. And Rav Moshe accepts that. But in this context, we don't have time to read it inside. I don't want to take up all the remaining time that we have. But we only have about 10 minutes left. But Rav Moshe, again, I gave it to you. You can take a look at it. For those who can read it on yourselves, you can see it. Rav Moshe himself is bothered by the Rama. The same thing was bothering me for all these years. I mean, Rav Moshe knew about it way before I did. I just didn't know about him. But I felt validated that I wasn't crazy. Rav Moshe himself says, I don't understand how could the Rama conflate the two. After all, we could imagine a scenario, says Rav Moshe, in which we were 100% sure that this Narishkeit has no pagan origin. Is it allowed or not allowed? But it's still an Arishkeit. Like, for example, let's say somebody, you know, does a very thorough Google search, because that's how you know have to research these days. And they prove to me, Rabbi Gottlieb, this thing with the clinking of the glasses had nothing to do with paganism. Whoever told you that, it's a Baba Maisa. It's really because the knights of yore used to spill their wine into each other's cup to make sure they weren't being poisoned. Okay? Now, let's say that's actually the reason, and somehow it's stuck for hundreds and hundreds of years throughout all, it's not just Western, pretty much every culture does that. No one has any idea why they're doing it. It's a total Narishkeit, but people do it. If that's the case, and we're sure there's no pagan origin, if that's true, so is it allowed or not? So says Rav Moshe, he thinks this would be a machlokas between the Maharik and the Ran. He says, how could the Rama put them together? Because in that case, I think they would argue. The Ran would be more lenient. If there's no pagan origin, it should be mutter. It's a Narishkeit. Who cares about Narishkeits? People do all sorts of silly things in life. As long as there's no pagan origin, I have to worry about it, it should be okay. Whereas the Maharik might say, I'm not saying it's also to do with the clinking of the glasses. I'm not ruling on that. I'm just saying, if the only reason you're doing it is because you want to be like the guy down the block, the guy's co-workers, so then what's the difference if it's something to do with Avodah Zarah? You shouldn't be doing things that make you look like you just want to be like them. So Rav Moshe seems to, I think, accept my reading that there really is two different conceptual approaches. And I think the way I read it, I think Rav Moshe accepts my view, or what I call the Chazon Ish view, which I think is much more relevant than the world we live in, because Nebuch, we live in such a secular culture. If we were living in a different culture, I would be much more worried about the Ran. But in our world, there's almost no, they barely have any Avodah Zarah in the base of Avodah Zarah anymore. First of all, the churches are empty. In Europe, again, Europe is gone. I mean, there's only one religion that's active in Europe right now, and it ain't a church. I'm saying, so, okay, but, so we shouldn't be doing things that are imitating Islam either. But the point is, I think we don't live in that world of paganism and Avodah Zarah. That's not our temptation. When I say our, I mean peoples, including many good Jews. Their temptation is the fitting in. Again, maybe less than Simchas Torah, but fitting in. Wanting to be like everybody else. Wanting to be accepted by our non-Jewish friends and neighbors, etc. That, I think, is still an active concern. And hypothetically, says Rav Moshe, that could be a problem no matter what. That could be more restrictive. Because it doesn't matter if it's got any paganism. However, Rav Moshe adds a major caveat about fashion. And this is, we're going to transition to the final part of the shiur in a minute. But let's just finish the halachic part. We're going to end off the halachic part now. Somebody asked, bottom line, Rabbi Gottlieb, assuming it's tzanua, is there something that I can't buy because you'll tell me if I went into the store it's going to be usher? So first of all, I would tell you, it would be very unlikely that it would be usher for you to buy any clothing, particular clothing, or shoe, or whatever, to dress a certain way, assuming it's tzanua. Because how many people really, I mean, you have to ask yourself, Alyssa's true, it's a little bit subjective, but how many people, again, adults for sure not, I hope, are doing things just to look like the non-Jewish world? I mean, certainly not in Ramat Beit Shemesh. But I'm saying even whether it's your beloved relatives who still live wherever they live, or when you used to live there, again, if you have to know yourself, if you were really doing it for that reason, maybe it would be a problem. But I don't even think it's that common that it'd be an issue. But, and here's Rav Moshe Feinstein's Chiddush for the 20th century Western Jew, let alone 21st century. He says, in any way, he thinks from a technical halakhic perspective, there's no problem at all, because in order for something to be chuko sa'akum, quote-unquote, goyish clothing, he says that has to mean, and apparently maybe in history there were periods where this did mean, that there was a way where only the goyim dressed. And now Mr. or Mrs. Jew, in some small numbers, want to adopt that so that they look like goyim. But says Rav Moshe, nowadays, are there clothing that's reserved for goyim and not for Jews? What's the clothing? If anything, there's one type of clothing that's reserved for Jews and not for goyim, right? For Hasidish men. But any other pair of clothing, could you look at anything and tell me, oh yeah, this is goyish clothing? I mean, those words sound almost anachronistic nowadays. We don't talk that way. And Rav Moshe is aware of this. Rav Moshe, who was like from another world, I'm saying, I mean, he wasn't like the savvy gadol. That was more of Yaakov Kamenetsky and other people. Rav Moshe was in the, you know, in with his books all day, so to speak. But he still had all of his feet on the ground. And Rav Moshe writes already in his day, this is set in the bottom part of source number 11, without anything we had said until now, Ein Shayach Isurim Ebushay Nachrim. The whole halacha doesn't really apply in a modern context. The Hakimat Kol Bnei Yisrael Lovshin Malbushin Elu. We're all wearing the same clothing. You go to the law firm, this lawyer looks like this lawyer. He's Goldberg, he's Smith. You go to the doctor's office, they all look the same, with or without the white coat. Says Rav Moshe explicitly, what are you talking about? Mi Omer Shehem Malbushin Nachrim. What's to say that this dress or this suit or this pair of shoes is goyish, is non-Jewish, and that the Jews are wearing the non-Jewish clothing? You ask, pick any designer, Mr. Gucci, Mrs. Whoever, Mrs. Versace, whoever. When you're designing the clothing, you only had in mind the goyim. Apitom. They want to do whoever. They want the more people as possible to buy their clothing.
They want to sell.
I'll add that half the designers are Jewish anyway. So what would, again, this is not my modern insight. Rav Moshe Feinstein made this point decades ago. So if you ask me from a strictly halachic perspective, almost impossible to violate this sister nowadays in the modern world that we live in. Almost impossible to violate. Good news.
Except the priest's clothes.
Okay, but fair enough. That's only a Purim Shiloh.
That's with clothing. What about doing something like this?
That's a good question. I try again. There's all sorts of topics we didn't even get to. We didn't get to Thanksgiving or secular holidays, non-Jewish names, the calendar. There are other ramifications of halacha which we didn't get to. We can't do everything in one shiur. But I want to go back to the clothing though, because I want to end. I think if I stopped here, I hope it was interesting. I hope it was valuable. But I don't think it's the main thing I want to. It's almost not the main thing I want to get to. I really want to end with the last group of sources, which is more hashkafic. And I say that because not only because hashkafa is always important, because I think it's especially important for the people in this room, meaning to say, everyone I could tell was relating to everything I said, because we're all not that far removed from when we did live in a non-Jewish culture. But Ashreinu Matov Hakeinu, no one at the moment does. So someone might be thinking, the whole shiur is irrelevant, because I live in Ramat Beit Shemesh, and even I live in Tel Aviv. I could live in Caesarea, I could live in Herzliya. There's still not a non-Jewish culture, it's a Jewish culture, it might be secular. So is this halacha even relevant? So I think the answer is that it is. Because I think what the Torah is teaching us is we have to have a certain pride in who we are. Who we are, if we're in a non-Jewish culture, means Jew versus non-Jew. And I think it also means, when we're lucky enough to live in Israel, it means that we're from. It doesn't mean that we have to wear a particular dress or a particular shirt. But that we should not want to ape the outside secular culture just to be accepted. I think that hashkafic message is absolutely relevant. But I'll go one step further, and this is what is the point that's made in the last three sources, which are very Pesach-related sources. So we're not even yet at Purim yet. We're already in the Geula mindset. We're all hoping for a lot of Geula and good things in the next few months. So in the Pesach story, going back to the first time the Jews were in the diaspora, surrounded by a non-Jewish dominant culture, majority culture was, of course, when we were in Egypt. And there's numerous sources. Again, we ran a little bit out of time. I'm going to finish in 2 minutes. But numerous sources that talk about how the Jews, even though we know they were not exactly so fafrumt when they were in Egypt, over time they lost a lot of their good behavior. But the number of sources that indicate that even to the end, they dressed differently. They did other things differently too. But our sources, they dressed differently. Now, why is that? Now, you might have thought, it was like a yellow star. They had no choice. Maybe the Egyptians told them they had to. However, in a number of sources, including source number 14, the Meshech Chachma, he says, no, it wasn't an accident. It was deliberate, and he suggests it goes back all the way to Yaakov Avinu. When Yaakov was still alive, that's when they first went down to Egypt, they were on top. They had Yosef in the palace looking after them. They were in their own ghetto in Goshen. They weren't being persecuted. They were wealthy. They had a lot of yeshivas. Yehuda had gone down to set up all the yeshivas. Things were great. But like any great leader, Yaakov knew it wasn't going to last. He could see the future, in a sense. And he knew that this is going to change. And the longer we're going to be in a dominant non-Jewish culture, the more threatened we are for assimilation. Never says the Meshech Chachma, based on the earlier sources, he designed certain things that you'll be more from, you'll be less from. You daven, you don't daven. You believe, you don't believe. But you have to remember you're a Jew. And one of the ways we remember who we are is how we dress. Too often people, particularly teenagers crave the identity the clothing gives them while simultaneously denying that they care what anyone thinks about them.
What?
They deny that they care about what anyone thinks about them. At the same time, this is the most thing they care about most in anything in life. Like, this is the paradox of being a teenager.
And yet we know that.
One second, please. So we have to realize, says the Meshech Chachma, again, the Ritva says it, it's really good back to the Medrash, that if we'll dress differently, we can't deny the fact that will impact our self-identity. And we have to remember, especially if we're in a non-Jewish culture, these sources are talking about non-Jewish, that we are different. So, yeah, a much better way to remember that we're different is that we turn off our phone for 25 hours and no one else does. Right? There are meaningful behavioral ways which are even more important than clothing. Clothing is only skin deep, that's true. But it doesn't mean it's irrelevant. We have to acknowledge the impact that the way we dress has on our self-identity, especially if we are a little bit different than the people around us. That will help us preserve our Jewish identity. These sources suggest that was the secret to the Jewish people being able to survive Egypt. There wouldn't have been any Jews left to redeem. As bad as it was, but at least they held on to who they were. And what helped them remember who they were? We dressed different. So I'm going to add, I think in a similar way, but even more subtle, I think this is relevant if you live even in Israel. Because one of the challenges, unique challenges, which is a way bigger topic than we're going to discuss now, is to the extent that people want to, and most of the people in this room, I think, for sure, and in our shul, for sure, want to feel part of greater Israel, want to be part of the greater society. And at the same time, we're very prone, and we should know this with our children and grandchildren, that it's a very slippery slope. And there has to be some way we remind them that, yes, we're proud to be Israeli, we're proud to, we feel the people in Tel Aviv are our brothers and our sisters, and the people at Nova who were doing one kind of dancing on Simchas Torah, and we were doing a completely different kind of dancing. They're our brothers and our sisters. So we want to care. But at the same time, we have to remember there are differences. So there are very meaningful ways to hopefully inculcate that. But I would not dismiss the relevance of dress or the importance of that, of helping them foster a very healthy identity. You can be fashionable, you can be attractive, you can be whatever. But I'm religious, I'm dosi, whatever term you want to use. It's incredibly tricky and a big, big challenge for us and our children. Again, in a certain sense, it'd be much easier to live in Bet and be Hasidish. They know they're different. And they're reminded every time they walk out the door. So if someone wants to vote for that, who am I to tell them they're wrong? But if you want to live the way we live, it doesn't mean that since I escaped Teaneck or Chicago or wherever, that it's all scot-free. It's true, I wouldn't really worry so much about a child here growing up and marrying out. That's almost guaranteed you've saved that if you were ever worried about that. I'm not sure how many of us are worried about that anyway, but if we were worried about that, Aliyah does help that almost automatically. But it's certainly no guarantee the child's going to be frum or proud to be frum. For sure not. So you can't wait till they're 26 and then worry about it. They have to have a very healthy, proud identity. So again, the more they feel separate from the rest of society, okay, you're going to help yourself, but do you want to? That's a big sacrifice. If you feel there's a value in them feeling part of Israel, then I think you definitely need to double down on, in a very smart way, on things like this. Because you, if they lose their sense of Jewish identity and only focus on their Israeli identity, but I keep Shabbos, maybe it'll last. Or maybe not. To cultivate a very sense of being a part of, but also a part from, it's a complicated balance. And I think we shouldn't ignore superficial things, because they may be inherently, does it really matter what clothing you wear? No, inherently not. It's all superficial. It's narishkeit. It's chitzoni. It's superficial. But it doesn't mean it doesn't have real impact on us. And for ourselves and for our children, I think there's a very important mussar and hashkafa lessons we can learn from this year that we think we should all do well to try to inculcate as much as we can.
And yet we know that when Yosef brought his two sons,